Okay, welcome back, everyone. Today we're going to look at some aspects of entangled quantum states. The first is a quick look at quantum teleportation, which is an idea that arose in the early days of the subject of quantum information, and there can be lots to be said about that. I want to use it just as a bit of an illustration about the use of entangled states and correlation, and also a bit about understanding when to use mixed states and pure states. So we'll see that pop up. And then we're going to have a quick overview of EPR and Bell, again looking at properties of entangled states and what the EPR and Bell arguments have to say about them. That's an enormous subject. And we'll just touch the surface of it, but I thought we could highlight some of the interesting aspects there. Again, it goes to the question of how do I really view this this object, this density matrix now that we use to describe quantum states. Okay. So let's do quantum teleportation first. And mathematically, it's extremely simple. So it won't take long to go through the details, but we can scratch our heads a bit about exactly what does it mean and whether the words quantum teleportation are, in fact, good descriptions of what's going on. So we imagine that we have two experimentalists named Alice and Bob. And they have some quantum systems in their lab. Alice has a system, we'll call it A. Let's just take it to be a two-level system, a qubit for the moment, but this can be generalized to any dimension, including infinite. She has some quantum system, which she's going to describe by some density operator, which could be a pure state. She has another system, A prime, which is in a maximally entangled state, a Bell state, with a system that Bob has, B. And I'll just draw a little squiggly line there to denote that A prime and B are in a maximally entangled state. We'll give the specific one in a moment. So all of this is inside Alice's lab. All of this is inside Bob's lab. One of the tricks when it comes to quantum information is it's very simple to go through the steps of applying quantum mechanics. We're going to take some quantum states, we're going to do a measurement, we're going to do a transformation, and then we're going to say, what's the final state? Well, as we started to see in some examples on Friday, what is the quantum state depends a bit on who's asking the question and what information they have. So with two parties, that becomes a bit more of a subtlety, and we'll sort of see how that comes out. Okay, so as I said, system A, which is in Alice's lab, is an arbitrary qubit state. Let's take it as an arbitrary pure state. So I'll denote with a little subscript there, A. This is going to be some superposition A0 plus B1. I'll make sure I keep my subscripts so we always know what system we're referring to. And it could be Alice has some preparation device. She understands it well and has characterized it at some Sturm-Gerlach apparatus or something. And so she is able to produce that state with some coefficients A and B that are known to her. Systems A prime and B, we're going to treat this as a joint system, is prepared in a Bell state. Sorry. And we can take this fiducial entangled state of A prime and B, which was 1 on root 2, 0, 0, A prime B, plus 1, 1, A prime B. And just a reminder, what do I mean when I write the state 0, 0? I mean the tensor product of the pure state 0 for a system A prime, tensor product with the pure state 0 for system B. There's the initial state of now. We can talk about even the larger joint system consisting of A prime B, and it is in a tensor product of psi A and this Bell state psi naught naught A prime B on this large system. So we know the initial state, and let's consider now doing a measurement on this system. And what we're going to do is measure A prime in the Bell basis. So if you recall, we defined a set of four states, psi ij, which were just locally related to zj. Locally related to this fiducial state. Those four Bell states form a basis, so we can think of them as entangled states, but equally well, we can think of performing a measurement in the basis given by those states. Now, you might ask, how do I do that? Well, first of all, note that it's on systems A and A prime. These are contained within Alice's lab. She has access to both of these systems. She says, I'm going to just treat this as a one quantum system of dimension 4, and I'm going to do a measurement on it, an observable whose eigenstates are those four states. Yeah?
We have sub-indexes A and A prime in the left side, and there's a B.
Oh, sorry. Yes, that is a mistake. Thanks. Please, please watch my indices. So that should be A prime. Yes, thank you. So you might ask the question, how does Alice do that measurement? It's maybe not obvious. You might ask how she can do it using measurements separately on particles A and A prime, and that would involve having to do some unitary coupling of those two particles first, in order to transfer a entangled basis to a local product basis. We're not going to get into the details of that. According to the way we've defined what's an allowed measurement in quantum mechanics, I can just pick any basis, and that even falls into my original definition of what we allow as a projective measurement in quantum mechanics. So it fits within our theory. It's useful to think for a moment about what is going on before we just start plowing into the mouths of this. We have some system A, and it's completely independent of two other systems, A prime and B, which are perfectly correlated. So we have perfect correlation between A prime and B. In doing this measurement in a Bell basis of A and A prime, Alice is in a sense querying something about the correlations between A and A prime. Now, there were no pre-existing correlations. Psi A was independent of this Bell state, but nonetheless, it's perfectly allowed to look at two independent things and say, are they the same? Are they different? In which way are they correlated? And you've learned something from that. And because of your pre-existing knowledge of the correlation between A prime and B, and the fact that you're now looking at whether there is any correlation between the properties of A and A prime, we expect to find ultimately a relationship between A and B. That's really what we're doing. We just have to be careful when we're talking about quantum mechanics, in operational quantum mechanics, that we don't start assigning properties to things. We have to be careful. So let's talk instead about using the rules of operational quantum mechanics and just looking at the predictions of measurements that we can do at the end. Okay, so let's go through the details of this combined system. Let me write this total state. Let me write it as phi A, A prime B. This is the state prior to measurement. Looks like, let's take that 1 on root 2 out front. A, 0 A plus B, 1 A. There's the initial uncorrelated state on A that Alice has. That's in a tensor product with 0, 0, A prime B plus 1, 1, A prime B. And I want to now imagine doing a projective measurement in this basis of A and A prime, and figuring out what does that mean for system B. And the natural thing to do to figure that out would be, well, let me just rewrite this state in a way that puts together A and A prime and decomposes that state in the basis, the Bell basis for an A and A prime, and see what we get. So it's just a bit of algebra rewriting what is this state. So let's just expand it out first. We have A, 0, 0, 0. Now I'll stop writing the subscripts when I put all three things, because you know it's A prime B. We have B, one, that's 1, 0, 0, plus A, 0, 1, 1, plus B, 1, 1, 1. And let us, now we have it written out for A and A prime in a product basis, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1. We want to write it out for A and A prime instead in this Bell basis. So it's just a change of basis. Let's just write it out explicitly. We have a component in the 0, 0, A prime plus 1, 1, A prime direction, and that component looks like A 0 B plus B 1 B. Of course, to get that to work, I need to put together a whole bunch of others, and there gets to be some cancellation of terms. So let me write it all out, and then we'll just sort of convince ourselves that it's true. And it looks like I've added a bunch of terms, but you'll see how they cancel off appropriately, that it's easy to show. You can take all of these terms, multiply it out, and you'll get this expression here. Okay, so what does this mean? All we've done is rewrite the initial state. We haven't done anything yet, except rewrite the initial state in a different basis, where we can say that initial state, which when written one way looked like an independent state on A and a maximally entangled state on A prime B, I rewrite it, and it looks like an equally weighted superposition of a whole bunch of entangled states in the Bell basis on A and A prime, and corresponding different states for the system B. Can I think about, okay, so when I measure this system in the Bell basis, what's going to happen is I'm going to take the superposition and collapse it. According to the Born rule, it will pick out one of these possibilities. They will all occur with equal probability. So one of them occurs, and say I get this outcome, then the resulting state of Bob system B is collapsed into this one. If I got that outcome, I would get this one. What is it saying in terms of what we were describing before in a classical language about we had an independent system and then two correlated systems with some known correlation. And then we looked at the correlation between A and A prime. What this is telling me is that the correlation between A and A prime could be anything, any of sort of four options. They can be correlated or anti-correlated in both their X and Z. So we have to be careful. We don't want to assign values to observables that we haven't measured. But nonetheless, you can say there's many possible ways in which this arbitrary state A can be correlated with A prime. I look and I find it is one of those particular correlations. And once I know that, then that tells me, because I already knew how A prime and B were correlated, it tells me something about system B. That makes sense from a perspective of just trying to understand correlations. Here we're trying to apply it to a situation where we have to be careful and not assign objective properties to things that we have not yet measured.
Is it right to think of A and A prime as correlated prior to the measurement, prior to any collapse?
I don't think so, because they are clearly, okay, so they're clearly in a product state. Okay. They're not. Well, but you're looking at, you know,
you entangle your measurement essentially performs an entanglement.
So the after measurement, we haven't in this course, I'm leaving it until later this week, but we haven't talked about what happens after measurement. You can, if I did a projective measurement, use the standard update rule and say the system is now left in this one of these entangled states. But that's not really part of the story. It's my more like you know, I have I'm trying to think of a classical but non-ridiculous analogy. I won't even bother. The picture you can have here is just, instead of saying, oh, I'm somehow creating entanglement, that's not relevant to this story about quantum teleportation. The key here is that we're observing correlation between A and A prime because of a known relationship between A prime and B. That will tell me, when I observe a correlation, that will tell me something about how A is correlated with B. The original system over here is related to the one over there. Right.
And you can, transmit information instantaneously because Alice has to tell Bob what she measured, right?
So let's look at exactly that. That's what I want to do in the next slide. So if we imagine Alice does this measurement, and then she will, according to the rules of quantum mechanics, collapse the superposition state into one of the four eigenstates of what she's measured. And so Bob, his system will be left in one of these four states, depending on the measurement outcome that Alice gets. So we can label the measurement outcome by just two bits, I and J, corresponding to whether she gets the 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, or 1, 1 outcome. And that will sort of pick out the right component. Now, from Alice's perspective, as soon as she does that measurement, she prepared the state psi A. She knows what it is. There's a correlation between A prime and B, which she's aware of. So she's the one who's written down this equation and says, I measure an outcome. Okay, I can't predict which one I'm going to get, but I do the experiment. One of these occurs with equal probability. And now Alice says, I know the state of Bob's system. Bob doesn't yet know. So Alice must send the classical outcome of her measurement to Bob in order for anything interesting to happen here. And so why is that? Question?
Yeah, she doesn't actually know the state of Bob's spin, right? Because like,
so let's be clear what she knows is that if she knew that her system A prime and B are in this entangled state initially.
Yeah, but she doesn't know her own initial state.
This one? Well, I said she prepared it. So we can also ask the question, what if she doesn't know that? But the way I posed this problem, she prepared that state psi A. You don't like that?
It's like the whole point that you don't know the state and you can transport it anyway. If I know the state, I can just tell him what A and B are and he can prepare it.
It is, so yes, it is interesting that if I wanted to send the information about A and B, they're complex numbers. Instead, she's sending two bits of information. So just in terms of how much...
And an entangled particle, which yeah. Seems in practice pretty hard.
Agreed. I guess I'm trying to illustrate a perspective on one experiment where Alice initially knows his state. Of course, we can then ask the question, what if she doesn't? So let me come to that in a second. Let's visit it now. If Alice says, I have some preparation, but I didn't prepare it, I have some state of system A, but it was handed to me by, yet another party, Charlie. I don't even know what the coefficients A and B are. She knows, nonetheless, something about how Bob's system relates to that original state, even if she doesn't know what that state is. But what she does know is this classical outcome. Why does she have to send it to Bob for anything interesting to happen? So let's put aside Alice's knowledge for a second and think about Bob's. That the final state, the post-measurement state of Bob's particle, B, if he said this process has occurred, but I haven't yet got these measurement outcomes, then he either has this state with 1/4 probability, or this state with 1/4 probability, or this state with 1/4 probability, or this state with 1/4 probability. We know how to represent that within quantum mechanics. We use a mixed state. We use an ensemble. So the first option there was actually the original state of Alice's particle on A, but now it is describing Bob's particle. So it is the description of that state, which now applies to Bob's particle. That's with probability 1/4. With probability 1/4, it looks like a transformed version of Bob's particle, transformed by the Pauli operator X, viewed as a unitary. With 1/4 probability, it looks like that state transformed by the Pauli operator Y. And with 1/4, it looks like that state transformed by the Pauli operator Z. And we can say this is a density matrix. We can work out what is that density matrix. And we find it is half the identity on Bob's system for any state psi. So if, you know, here's again just, I'm emphasizing this as an application of mixed states and when do we use an ensemble representation. It depends a lot on our knowledge of the system. And in this case, if Bob did not have the measurement outcome, he would describe the state of his system by this completely mixed state. That's exactly the way he would have described it if he said that none of this teleportation stuff had happened at all, if he just had half an entangled state shared with Alice and nothing has happened. What's the reduced density matrix for half an entangled state? It's the completely mixed state on Bob's system. So the formalism here is capturing exactly what Bob knows about the system, independent of what is going on in someone else's lab at the other end of the world. It shouldn't matter, and it doesn't matter. You should be relieved when you see this. He has half an entangled state. I can make all the predictions about what the outcomes of measurements on my half of this entangled state. I can, all the predictions that I can make on that system B can be reproduced by describing it by the density matrix half the identity, the completely mixed state. If Alice does some measurements over there, that doesn't change his description of the state. The only time he changes his description of the state is if he receives the information from Alice that says, I got the measurement outcome IJ. Your state is actually going to be this one. And if you wanted, you could transform it such as to relate it to the original state that I have. Any questions on that? So you'll probably see quantum teleportation again and again if you do the quantum information course. And I don't want to highlight on all of the sort of useful applications that you can do with this type of protocol. What I wanted to do here was emphasize how, depending on your knowledge of the system and about measurements done here or elsewhere when it's entangled state, you have to use one or another of the density matrix formalisms. Like, we have to pick the right ensemble. We have to represent that state using the information that we have. And if you do, you're not going to get into any weird contradictions with locality and relativity and so on. Okay. Any questions on teleportation? Yeah?
No, it's not a question. I was going to tell you something, Nick, that maybe you said that, okay, if you can tell the measurement, why wouldn't you send directly A and B? Are you? It was for you. That you argue that if I can tell him what Alice measured, why wouldn't I tell him A and B? So yes. He directly prepares a state. Yes. But maybe to prepare that state, I guess, imagine that you need a really specific machinery or...
In order to prepare that state,
yeah,
it's just
a
have to
B.
Measure in a certain direction and half the times I will get the right answer. I can just project on getting either... I can just project up. I just have to choose the right axis and measure, and I get either either a 1 or a 0, and if it's a 1, then it's the right state, and if I get a 0, it's the wrong state, so I try again.
Yeah,
so
but I mean, if you don't have the way to project, you just have an entangled system with another one.
So you can make entangled states and throw them to the other side of the Earth without destroying the entanglement, but you can't measure a spin.
You don't know the situation of the lab.
So let me interrupt here. I mean, this is actually a line of research that's been pursued. I mean, some time ago now, in the early days of this, but when people looked at the idea of remote state preparation. And what are the minimum resources I need to prepare a state that I have a description of in someone else's lab. It's worth perhaps emphasizing, although I worked out this example where I said Alice describes her system by some pure state psi A, this example also works if system A is in an arbitrary entangled state with any number of other systems, and that in teleporting the state, the entanglement ends up going with it. So in that type of situation, you wouldn't, even if Alice said, I definitely know that my system A is in half an entangled state, this procedure would allow her to send that entanglement to Bob and have Bob sort of join in that entangled state in a known way through exactly this type of procedure. So that's a good exercise to go through to see that this is really a linear process, and that this will work even if A is not a product state. Okay. Any last questions on teleportation? I'm sure you'll see lots of it if you keep on.
The point of your last slide was just that the density matrix essentially doesn't change before. Well, one of the points was that the density matrix doesn't change whether or not he knows that Alice is performed a particular measurement or not. Right? That in both cases, it's completely fixed.
Yeah, an advantage of this formalism is that he doesn't have to update his description based on what may be occurring in a lab that is outside his, you know, past light cone. I mean, it's compatible with that idea of, I don't want to say relativity because we have a universe here of two points, but it's compatible with the fact that the description of his system will only depend on his local information and not on things that happen at some distant lab. You know, there's lots of discussion in the popular literature about entangled states creating sort of spooky action at a distance where the wave function can instantly change at the other end of the universe. And we see that in this description, you don't have any of that. That if you follow this formalism, the way that Bob represents his state only changes either when he does something to it or when he learns information about measurements done on a correlated system elsewhere, only when that information arrives to him. Okay, but that's a great segue to the next topic of today. We'll see how far we get into it, where we're going to look at EPR and Bell, because it was precisely so. Quantum teleportation only came about in the 90s. The arguments between Einstein and Bohr go back 100 years, but in many ways they were asking very similar types of questions about what is this quantum state. Is it a state of my knowledge about a system, or is it something that describes the physical properties of an objective reality that's out there? Despite the fact that we normally associate Bohr with saying, oh, you can't talk about objective properties and so on, he nonetheless really put forward the idea that this quantum state describes everything. It's all you can possibly know. And so if there's anything real, it's the quantum state. It's the wave function. This quote up here is typical Bohr, where it's a bit of a mouthful to figure out exactly what he means by that. But he's trying to say that the wave function is all one can possibly, it's a complete description of the system, and therefore it is a perfectly good candidate for describing the physical world that's out there and independent of us. Einstein, of course, took a very different view on this. He looked at some of the early work in quantum mechanics, much like we're just looking at now, with entanglement and superposition, and said all of this stuff to do with wave function collapse and updates from measurements and so on looks to me as if I am merely changing my description of a system where there are properties of it that I cannot access. So we have this famous quote that God does not play dice. In a bit more of an elaboration, he says, I really want to think of this wave function, this quantum state, as an incomplete description of what's really going on out there. The incompleteness of the description is forced by the fact that the observation of the state is only able to grasp part of the real situation. So he's trying to argue that the wave function to him looks like something that is describing our knowledge about the system, and that it necessarily is incomplete knowledge. And really, there's stuff out there that's going on, and he wanted to seek a more fundamental theory that may explain what's really going on. He didn't want to believe that the outcomes that you get from measurement being random were in any sense truly random. He wanted to say there's really something describing those outcomes. They look random to me because I don't have an accurate or complete enough description of the system to predict what's going to happen. But if I had that additional information, I would be able to predict it. That information exists in the real world, and I just don't have access to that full knowledge. So there's this great story about Einstein and Bohr arguing over the meaning of the wave function back in the early days of quantum mechanics. Let's see if we can try to formulate exactly what it was that bothered Einstein. So this was an argument that he really developed over many years, over the course of a decade, and which culminated in the EPR paper. So he looked at what the basic application of quantum mechanics seems to predict, that there's some wave function that can describe multiple particles, say in entangled states, and that those things can become very non-local to each other. So we imagine in this picture of the time that people said there's wave functions of particles in entangled states that are sort of spreading out and maybe going out well beyond the light cones of each other. And then we imagine that if we perform a measurement over here, our rules of quantum mechanics that we're developing seem to say that that wave function collapses, and the wave function over here, describing this particle that I didn't measure, somehow changes instantaneously. And of course he was disturbed by this, because it seems to violate the spirit of relativity, even if it doesn't directly contradict it in saying that you can send signals faster than light. It looks like something's happening faster than light, and he was disturbed by that. And he says there must be an alternative way of looking at this in terms of the wave function being a description of my knowledge of the system. And it's perfectly natural for me to say that if there are two particles that I know are correlated in some way, but I don't know everything about them, and that I then learn something about one of those particles, and I already knew it was correlated with another particle, then sort of instantaneously, across space and time, I know something about that other particle due to the fact that I measured this one, learned something about it, and I know from the beginning that it was correlated with that one. So this idea of hidden variables, I mean, there's a lot of baggage with that word now, but that is now a broad term used to describe the type of thing that Einstein was looking for, that there was some additional information inaccessible to us out there, which is describing the outcomes of measurements. And the wave function is only describing something about my knowledge of those more fundamental degrees of freedom in the system. Okay, so Einstein, you know, had this this whole picture in mind, and started to argue with people. It really sort of kicked off at this 1927 Solvay conference when he really tried to formulate this in terms of a specific type of experiment, where I start off with something like an entangled state. He didn't write it in terms of two-dimensional quantum systems. He described it more in terms of position and momentum, but nonetheless, the ideas sort of map across directly. If I have some quantum state, like the one that we were looking at between Alice and Bob, which might be this, I send those two particles to distant labs. Alice measures, say, Z and gets, say, the outcome 0 or plus 1. Then quantum mechanics, just as naively applied, seems to say that Bob's state should instantly update to the state 0. It was in an entangled state, thought of as a physical wave function that's described by some wave propagating between these two labs. And then as soon as Alice measures, say, the Z observable and gets plus 1, Bob's quantum state, if it's a physical wave function, changes right away to 0.
No, to
1.
Hmm?
Plus 1.
Yeah, the plus 1 outcome plus one corresponding outcome to the state 0. The plus one eigenstate of the Pauli Z operator. So. So there's, whoops. Yeah, sorry, I wrote over my pop-up slides. So what did I say here? So yeah, if you take Bohr's view on things, that this wave function is sort of a complete description and can be viewed as sort of a wave that is out there, then something very weird and non-local is going on. So this is what Einstein called spooky action at a distance. He wasn't saying that quantum mechanics has spooky action at a distance. He was insulting Bohr's view of quantum mechanics. He says, if you want to believe that, that this wave function is you know, some physical wave out there, then you need to have spooky action at a distance.
Did you really use the word spooky?
I mean, he said
what's German?
Something in German, right?
He did?
Yeah, he said it in word.
Okay. Yeah, so this this argument, I mean, he took this basic idea, which is to say, look, if you took it from my perspective, which is that I have these correlated particles, they actually have some value of whether they're 0, 0 or 1, 1. You know, there's some underlying theory that I don't know about that explains what measurement outcomes are going to occur. I just don't know it. I'm describing this system by incomplete knowledge and using correlation. I say, I know there's a correlation, but I don't know anything about the outcomes. I just know these two particles are correlated. Then when I measure Z here, and of course I'm going to say that the system over there is going to be the same outcome because I knew they were correlated. Whatever I get here, my knowledge of the system over here is instantly updated. So if you really take that view that the wave function is somehow your description of knowledge, then Einstein's view of this thought experiment is not weird at all. But if you take Bohr's view, then it's this very weird, spooky action at a distance. So it took some number of years, but Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen sort of formalized this argument into their famous EPR paper. And what they show in that paper is that if you take three assumptions, you can derive a contradiction. So the three assumptions are that there is some local reality that there's a universe out there that we're describing. There's variables, properties of systems, and that they have to evolve and update according to local rules. That this wave function is a complete description, and that the predictions of quantum theory are correct. And they formulated it in a way that they say, well, this is obviously true. I mean, that's Einstein's perspective, that there is some sort of local reality out there. And this one is, of course, borne out by experiment. We see that it is true and accurate. So therefore, it's this assumption that must be wrong. That was EPR's argument, that it's the completeness of the wave function, which is the assumption there that you should discard. Interestingly, most of the community at the time didn't really buy it. They were much more willing to discard with the idea of a local reality and go even more into Bohr's view that we shouldn't talk about particles having properties. We can't talk about the outcomes of measurements that have not yet been performed. That wave function is a complete description of our reality, and what you have to give up is something about your notion of reality. Einstein was unable to convince the physics community at the time, but he really put this forward to try to knock down Bohr's argument. Now, it was decades later, unfortunately after Einstein's death, that Bell basically showed that this second assumption is not even necessary to derive the contradiction. That we have a contradiction basically between this and this. And we're going to expand on that. But yeah, so just a bit of a history. There's this long, great debate subsequently after this EPR paper. EPR puts out, can quantum mechanical description of physical reality be considered complete? That's their famous EPR paper. It's a classic. I encourage you to read it at some point. Bohr puts out his rebuttal. Can quantum mechanical description of physical reality be considered complete? It's the same title. It's a very challenging paper to actually extract much out of. Really, it's Bohr, you know, giving his view on, well, you can't assign values to things that you haven't measured, and you know there really can't be some objective reality out there. And it's not nearly as clear a paper as the EPR one, but the community seems to converge on the idea that Bohr wins the argument. That instead of giving up that completeness of the wave function, we should give up the idea of reality. So that's quite a striking sociological fact. I think it's testament to just how esteemed Bohr was in the community for all the work that he did as a physicist, that people really went over to his view on that. And there things sat for a long time until Bell came along. And this is just quite remarkable, that Bell showed that, we can remove this assumption of completeness from the EPR argument, and basically show that regardless of whether I think the wave function is complete or incomplete, whether I have some sort of hidden variable theory, or I'm treating the wave function as some sort of real wave or whatever, that I can show a contradiction between local realism and quantum mechanics. So it basically, the type of thing that Einstein wanted was ruled out. It doesn't mean that there can't be some theory that explains what's going on, and for which there's a real world out there, and for which the wave function is just our knowledge about those predictions. Such a theory can still exist. You can still have that type of theory, except it has to be non-local. If you say, oh, okay, well, we shouldn't take that view then. I don't like hidden variables anyway. I'm going to take the notion that the wave function is a complete description, and I really have to think of it as a physical reality. Well, you're still out of luck that that description also can't be local. There's no way out for either side of the argument there. Local reality is just in contradiction with the rules of quantum mechanics. Okay, so what we're going to try to do in the last 20 or so minutes is a sketch of a Bell-type argument. So there's a long history here, and if you take the Foundations course, I'm sure you'll go through the details much more carefully. What we're going to do here is look at the type of argument that Bell proposed, the standard one, which is the CHSH argument, is very general and quite definitive. We're not going to go through that because it's a bit involved, and I'll leave that for the Foundations course. We'll look at a slightly restricted version of a Bell-type argument. I'll make it clear where the restriction comes in. But it's basically just going to be a simple requirement that we want our hidden variable theory to reproduce certain aspects of quantum mechanics perfectly. So it's going to be just an extension of the EPR argument, but now just with more measurements. The idea is that we're not going to just look at measurements where we see correlation, but we're then going to look at other measurements as well, and the whole Bell theorem comes about because of this tension between the fact that we want to have correlations in our measurements, but also we have to have local uncertainty that's compatible with quantum mechanics. Okay, so let's go through a basic type of Bell argument, and so you can get a flavor for how these things work. Okay, so let's again take an entangled state of two particles. And let's take the singlet state this time. The nice thing about the singlet is that no matter if Alice and Bob measure in the same measurement basis, they always get anti-correlated outcomes. Okay, what we're going to do is give these two parties some freedom of choice as to what measurement they're going to do. And then we're going to repeat this experiment many, many times where they can change around their measurement settings. So each party is going to measure along one of three directions on the Bloch sphere, separated by 120 degrees. So just think of, as I've drawn here, two Stern-Gerlach devices where they're choosing for each run of the experiment whether to set that Stern-Gerlach gradient to A, B, or C. Of course, you'd imagine probably doing this experiment with entangled photon pairs, in which case you'd set some polarization analyzer to one of those different settings. Okay, so here's the basic idea of what we're going to do in a run of the experiment. We create the entangled state. Okay, Alice, the person on the left, measures particle one in the direction A, B, or C, chosen at random. When I say measurement in the direction A, I mean quantum state associated with the Bloch vector A and its orthogonal state. So we're doing a projective measurement in the direction A and A perp, or B and B perp, or C and C perp. Bob does the same thing.
You're in the plane right now, the slice of the Bloch sphere? Or?
Yeah. And due to the invariance of the singlet state, it doesn't even matter what plane. Okay.
Yeah.
Bob measures particle two. at random. They record the outcomes. And then repeat. They do many identical, repetitions of this experiment. Alice picks one of the three directions. Bob picks one of the three directions. They both measure their particle from that singlet state. Then they prepare another singlet state, another pair of random directions, measure it, repeat, repeat, repeat. And then it's sort of obvious from this, but I'll write it out explicitly. Sometimes, that is one third of the time, they pick the same measurement direction. And other times, it's different. What we're going to demand in our, we're going to say, this was Bell's genius, really, is to come up with a way of saying, here are all possible theories that are local realistic theories for which we say there is a predetermined outcome for these measurements determined by something, and it can be anything, but it has to be set locally. It can't depend on things that occur on the other side of the universe. To come up with a framework for saying, here are all such possible theories, and just really thinking of them as instruction sets which will just tell you what happens in given instances of the experiment. And to show then that we can derive a contradiction between the predictions of quantum mechanics and the predictions of any such theory. Just by the fact that there is freedom of choice, sometimes they're going to be the same measurement direction, and we're going to have to demand, because it's a singlet state, that they give anti-correlated outcomes. Other times, they're in the same direction, and quantum mechanics allows for some probabilities for these outcomes, which are just completely inconsistent with our previous demands on our local realistic theory. So let's see if we can describe that. So here's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to rule out any possible hidden variable model that can describe this. So many runs of the experiment, the directions are chosen randomly and independently by Alice and Bob. It's a key assumption in this Bell test. They can generate those random numbers from measuring quantum states if they want, or you can assume that they have free will and they're somehow just able to pick random numbers. But that is a key assumption in this whole thing, that they can pick those directions independently and randomly. Yep?
You do mean exclude any local hidden variable theories, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Very good point. I should put that in there. Yes, exactly. It certainly does not exclude ones with non-local degrees of freedom. So here's a question. How do I construct the most general type of local hidden variable model that is going to be able to explain these predictions? And let's look at some properties of those predictions. So the notion here is that we just have some instruction set. And it can actually have randomness in it, but it just has to say when there's a particular measurement setting for one particle or for one measurement, in this particular run, here is the outcome it's going to have to give. And it can't depend on the setting at the other end of the experiment. Okay? It has to give an outcome, and it has to be either predetermined by something at the source. It has to know what a measurement setting is going to occur, and so it can give different outcomes for different measurement settings. But it has to have An answer to the question when interrogated, I'm measuring you in a spaces, what's the outcome? It has to have that in a way that doesn't depend on what's going on at the other end of the lab. Okay, I don't know why it says A and A there. A and A. So that's like Alice measures in the A direction and Bob measures in the A direction. That's the constraint we're going to put on our model. That's why it's not a fully general CHSH inequality that we're deriving. We're going to demand that our model exactly reproduce that aspect of quantum mechanics, that whenever we measure in the same direction, we have to get opposite outcomes as predicted by the singlet. The full CHS solution doesn't demand that. It can just get statistics that are close to that and so on. It's interesting to go through that more general detail, but we're not going to do it now. We're just trying to give you a flavor of the argument here. Okay, so let's think of an instruction set. For each pair of particles, which is basically going to be a list for each particle, it could look like, say, plus, minus, plus, which means if A is measured, then give the outcome plus. If B is measured, then give the outcome minus. If C is measured, then give the outcome plus. What's setting those rules? It could be anything. There could be a computer inside every single particle that's going through some complex calculation to try to figure out, oh, I'm about to get subjected to a measurement. Depending on the direction, I got to figure out what outcome I'm going to give. It can do anything it wants. So the idea, we're not going to try to figure out a good dynamical theory for where these instruction sets come from. They could be arbitrarily complicated. They can involve a conspiracy between those two particles at their creation about, OK, in this round, here's what we're going to do. In the next round, we're going to do this. It can come from anywhere. We're just going to look at basic properties of those instruction sets themselves, regardless of their origin. So let's just think of all possible instruction sets. We have a pair of particles, so we need to give, in each case, a pair of instruction sets for particle 1 and particle 2. And we're going to impose that the constraint on our model as written above there, that if they get measured in the same direction, they have to be the opposite outcome. So imagine particle 1 has the instruction set plus, plus, plus. Then particle 2 has to have the instruction set minus, minus, minus. That means no matter what direction particle 1 is, it will always give the outcome plus. Particle 2 will always give the outcome minus. Maybe we don't like that instruction set. Maybe we only want that to occur some of the time. So there's going to be other possibilities, like plus, plus, minus. That has to be paired up with the other particle being in minus, minus, plus. Because if we measured A for both, he gave plus, so he has to give minus. If we measured C for both, particle 1 gave minus, so particle 2 has to give plus. There's a whole list of these, all the way down to minus, minus, minus. And that has to be matched up with plus, plus, plus. Let me write the second last one here. OK, when do they choose this instruction set, this one, whatever? There's an arbitrary rule for how they decide on a given day, OK, I'm going to go off with my instruction set. You're going to go off with your instruction set. We're going to pick this one now, or we're going to pick that one now. Or we have some complex process by which we decide you know, through some extensive computation based on the time of day and the weather and so on, which one we're going to pick. But whenever I pick this one, you have to pick that one, because we have to make sure if they just happen to pick the same measurement directions, we better give opposite outcomes. We've got to do that. Okay, now let's think about not just the instances where those measurement directions are the same, but let's think of all measurements. For all possible measurements, here, the probability that we're going to get opposite outcomes is equal to 1. And there, I don't mean opposite outcomes when we measure in the same direction. We demanded that that was going to be for certain. Here, even if we measure in different directions, we get opposite outcomes. That's just the nature of that instruction set. If we measured particle 1 in plus, and in A, and particle 2 in C, this one gives plus and this one gives minus. They're opposite outcomes. In fact, you can just see it's apparent from that instruction set, no matter what I measure, ABC, ABC, I always get plus and minus. I always get opposite. Down here, this one is also, if that were the instruction set on a given run, then you will, no matter what you do, the probability of getting opposite outcomes is 1. For all these ones in between, what's the probability of getting opposite outcomes? There's 9 possible settings, A, B, and C for particle 1, A, B, and C for particle 2. We already know you have to get opposite outcomes if it's A and A, or B and B, or C and C. So 3 of those 9 possibilities lead to opposite outcomes for sure. But then you can also just check in this one, you know, like A and B give opposite outcomes, and so do B and A. There's actually 5 of the 9 possible joint settings give opposite outcomes. And that's true of everything else on that list. So by demanding that they always gave opposite outcomes when we measured the same thing at random, then when we measure anything we want, we will always have, no matter what instruction sets are chosen or what sampling of instruction sets, whether we sometimes pick this one, then this one, then this one, then this one, whatever distribution you have, you'll never get opposite outcomes occurring less than 5/9 of the time. Because that's the lowest probability that any instruction set gives. You cannot write down a model where there are well-defined values once the particles separate. They've already decided on their answer. Where we demand that they give opposite outcomes when measured in the same direction. You can't have a model that has that, where now, over all possible random settings, the probability of getting outcomes that are opposite is less than 5/9. So this is the trickiest part of any Bell test, is really convincing yourself that the statistical property I'm looking at for my hidden variable model is it's really capturing all possibilities. I don't want to have a loophole somehow in saying, oh, well, you know, if they knew to somehow to pick this instruction set at that time, then they could get around whatever bound I'm trying to do. No, you want it rock solid, no matter how you try to come up with that model, you're going to have the statistics obey a certain property. And in this case, the probability, well, let me write it out explicitly. Any theory that selects these instructions from any ruler distribution will predict, will never predict. a probability of opposite outcomes being less than 5/9. So if you're sitting there going, just not quite, there must be something. That's the whole thing in these Bell arguments. The quantum mechanical argument is then going to be easy. We're going to show that this experiment done with quantum mechanics predicts this number to be like 1/2 or something. So it explicitly violates this constraint. Doing the quantum mechanics is going to be easy. And in fact, we'll leave it till tomorrow's lecture. We'll cover it quickly. What is the most difficult part of understanding these ideas of Bell tests is convincing yourself, I really have captured the idea of any possible theory that just doesn't allow communication between the particles. It would be a very different thing if the particles were allowed to say, oh, call them up on the phone, I'm about to get measured in direction A. What should I say? Oh, I'm about to get measured in B. Let's agree to give the same outcome so we can confound this bound. If they can call each other, then they can circumvent this. But if they have to set off in their separate ways with this rule that, okay, if you get A, I have to, when it's A, I give the opposite. If you get B, if I get B, it's the opposite. If they have to agree on that beforehand, then they're completely constrained by what they can do, even with these different settings. Okay, so I think that's a good place to stop, or at least pause. What we're going to do tomorrow, it only takes like 2 minutes to work through how the quantum prediction is like 1/2, which is clearly in contradiction to this statement. And therefore, we'll discuss a bit about what that means for things like no signaling and the future of local models for quantum mechanics. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.